slip right in among the very heart of you.
Well, this is Mental Health Radio, taken from us, and I'm host Sheldon Brown, and I hope that you have signed in, as Rita Murdoch's many lines says, signing in. I guess that's all about signing into life as well, and as well as signing in to Take It From Us Today. Well, today we bring you another broadcast from the podcasts that are supplied by Mad in America. We played one of these podcasts about 3 or 4 weeks ago, and have established a relationship with Mad in America to play more of these. Today's is an interview with a Dr. Pratima Singh. Dr. Singh is a UK psychiatrist who talked critically about the profession and how we should be adopting a more holistic approach to managing mental health. And apologies in advance, as the audio on this broadcast isn't of the highest quality, but the issues that Dr. Pratima Singh raises about psychiatric medication and mental health are very relevant in New Zealand. So let's hear this interview with Mad in America's James with Dr. Pratima Singh.
I originally come from India, where I did my medical degree. And while I was there, I think it became apparent very quickly that I was naturally attracted to psychiatry, as well as, I mean, luckily, psychiatry liked me as well. So I got a lot of positive feedback from my supervisors that, you know, what I was really good at is, you know, sitting down with people and having conversations that, you know, maybe some other doctors found difficult or avoided. So I think that's what started it. But I was also very fortunate to have a mentor who really influenced my interest in a more scientific way in this field, and, you know, really got me interested in the psychopathology about, you know, how people start to develop these different state of minds and in times of crisis. So that is what started it off. But I guess my departure from India was due to a particular reason, and that was I always felt quite uncomfortable about how biological psychiatry was in India. So medication was heavily used, and I mean, if you keep in mind circumstances in a developing country, you know, that's not surprising. We have very few resources for psychotherapy even today, you know. So I left India about 15 years ago, and you know, the area of research in mental health was still quite in its nascent stages. So although we had a few premier institutes in India, the mainstream psychiatry training was very biological, and I think I didn't want that. I was very interested in psychotherapy and about what I was reading. So that's what attracted me to Europe, and actually to Maudsley in particular, because that was the only name I knew, and I was very lucky to be supported by my mentor in this journey. And, you know, after being here, things were pretty straightforward for me, because it's a specialty that has great difficulty in recruiting, which for me meant that I had no difficulty entering the profession. But on the flip side, I found myself surrounded by people for whom this specialty was not the first choice. And I think that again was quite difficult for the few of us who were in this specialty, because we felt passionate, and it was not a default choice, because we, you know, there was difficulty in getting into other fields. And I think that created interesting obstacles in the journey. But, you know, 15 years in the Western medical system working in mental health has given me a much more nuanced and, I would say, humble appreciation of how things worked back in India that I took for granted. So, for example, you know, just appreciating the advantage of a less individualistic society and importance of strong family structures, or, you know, the contemplative practices like prayer or meditation or yoga within the culture. You know, these were the things I did not appreciate when I was there and when I left India. And then coming here and seeing how we are making so much more of an effort to kind of integrate this into a modern lifestyle has been really interesting. So I continued my training, but I was very fortunate. I did my training in Charing Cross Rotation and then the Maudsley Rotation. And I think overall, although I would say the training was excellent, my discontentment about the biological approach continued. And I think it has led to me to be here where I am. So I currently work as a community psychiatrist. Yep. In one of the most deprived boroughs of London. And I see patients who are first referred to secondary mental health services. So I see them quite early on in their journey. Mm. And I feel really privileged that I get to do what I do.
Thank you, Dr. Singh. And could you help me understand broadly how psychiatric services in the UK work to support those with mental health difficulties, and perhaps your experience of how that has changed in recent times?
So, as I said earlier, James, I think it's important to keep in mind that the majority of mental health problems or difficulties is actually taken care of in the primary care. So it's our GPs who are dealing with the maximum burden of mental health problems, up to about 80%. And I think with inclusion of the IAPT, which is Integrated Access to Psychological Therapies, in the recent years, what used to be just GPs, they now have access to talking treatments. And I think that has been a huge progress. So anything that is not within the realm of primary care is then looked after in secondary care. So secondary care structures have evolved. So there has been a big shift from the large institutions or old style asylums to more community-based cares. And this has evolved from the old style community mental health team, or CMHTs in short, where patients are looked after by a team that consists of care coordinators who might be nurses, social workers, occupational therapists. They have psychiatrists, and the idea was that these care coordinators would develop a relationship and have deal with the patient in a way that forges a relationship and gives opportunity to focus on whatever the need might be. So sometimes it could be about medication, but many other times it can be very practical aspects of what they are struggling in their life, or things that have happened a long time ago that are repeating in a sort of a pattern that might require more psychological attention and therapy. So that used to be the CMHT. And then we have the acute care, or crisis care, which includes the inpatient beds, or people seen in crisis in anywhere there might or might not be a psychiatry liaison service. So this is a small team of mental health workers who support the A&E staff in dealing with a psychiatric crisis. Mm. And then there is also a home treatment team, or the crisis resolution team, as it's called in some parts of the country, where the hope is that patients are treated in the most suitable setting, which for many patients might be their own home rather than a ward that can be quite acutely disturbed. So the home treatment team were brought in as an alternative to hospital admissions, so that people would have an opportunity, if needed, to have an alternative to hospital care. And then I think based on a patient's specific needs, there has been diversification into more specialist services for learning disability, neuropsychiatry, eating disorder. And I think these are very varied throughout the country, depending on the size of the trust, what resources they have, and importantly, what they are commissioned to do. And so I think focusing on how community care has changed in recent times. So like any good thing gone too far, we have drastically and too rapidly cut down inpatient beds. So I think the number is around 20,000 acute inpatient psychiatric beds have been cut down over the past few decades. And this has not really translated into a complementary development of community services. So I think we are left with a huge gap. So we now have community mental health teams that are looking after more and more people. But we are also kind of expected to look after people at the points where it might not be safe to do so. And this pressure, this focus to has been mainly to reduce cost. And so that definitely has been a gradual and consistent disinvestment in mental health services. And so we have community mental health teams that now are starting to reconfigure so that they can do more with less resources, which means that it stops having this long-term focus and starts to look more like an acute care model where you are expected to see people quickly, do stuff quickly, and then discharge them quickly. So in practice, you know, just because there's a model does not mean that this is how it would work. In practice, what happens is that people's need are chronic, even though they might present in an acute crisis, or they might present what seems on surface like a, you know, not a very severe problem, might have roots that go down sometimes back to their childhood traumas or things that have happened in their family, like loss of a loved one or loss of employment or start of a psychotic illness. You know, so things that might look like they can be dealt with quickly, but actually require a lot of time and relationship. We have really struggled to do that in 12 weeks. Our patients routinely now remain with in our team over 6 months, sometimes even over a year. And there is a bottleneck to transfer these patients to the long-term teams, which are slightly better resourced to look after people this way. But at the same time, they are already full because of the idiosyncrasies of the pathway. So I think the main impact and the main change in the recent times has been the constant pressure from commissioners, and rapid service reconfigurations mean that the contacts are more and more brief, which means that the people who actually end up in the acute pathway or actually end up in the inpatient beds are definitely more unwell than they would have been if the intervention would have been more timely. So the pressure is passed on to every part of the system. And I think if people are more unwell at admission, they remain in there for a longer period of time. They have more disruption of their lives. They take longer to get better and be discharged. And the sicker you are, I think that has a prognostic, so that has an impact on how well you do in the longer term.
I can see that those financial pressures are working against the model of socially based community support that we want, aren't they? And I also wonder if that's one of the reasons why medication is so heavily relied on, because it's a relatively quick and cheap intervention, and that can be tempting when viewed through an economic lens.
Absolutely. And I think these things happen at quite a cohort level. And you are absolutely right. So, I mean, 10 years ago, when I was a trainee in a community mental health team, compared to that, it's mind-boggling. So I would say 99% of the patients I see in my community team now come with from the GP already on medication. And often they have already been on one, sometimes two medication, even before they arrive to secondary mental health care. I think so what that means by definition is that, you know, many people are arriving in the so-called treatment resistant phase. So they have tried at least two medications. You know, sometimes these trials are not adequate. They're not at adequate doses, or they're not long enough, but they've had input from IAP, CPT. So they are definitely arriving, having tried medication, in my opinion, a bit too early. And this is not to say that this is a problem for every patient. I mean, I definitely would be lying if I said that I do not come across people who say that medication has benefited them. But I would say that a majority of the patients who I'm asked to see I'm asked to see because medication isn't helping. And when I do a timeline, so that's one thing I do for every patient, is that I make a timeline of their life rather than look at what happened in the preceding 6 weeks and what is the dose of the medication that can be tinkered with. When you do a timeline, it certainly feels like there are clues right along their history about things that have created the imbalance, you know, maybe in terms of their relationship or how they have been living their life or what choices they have been making and why they are doing that. And I think that kind of reflection takes time, because I don't think it's an easy thing to do as a patient, that you know, you can open up that way. It's much easier to engage with a professional sometimes at the level of medication. But I must say that the other thing that strikes me, that I see more and more patients who will come to me and say that they do not want to try medication. And in terms of my training did not prepare me well. So nobody said that when a patient says this, you say this. But I think what you observe when you are a trainee is that you are covertly trained to convince people about benefits. And when we look at the evidence and the strength of the evidence, not only the evidence, but this actually the extent and the strength of it, it's quite weak. I mean, we don't have grounds to persuade our patients to take medication as strongly as we do. So, I mean, why are we doing it is an interesting question. And as you say, I think the system plays a role. I think if you are forced into a system where you have an acute care mindset, then you will respond with things where you'll be seen as doing something. So, you know, writing a prescription is a concrete example of something held, and you send away the patient with a promise, but possibly not having that much discussion about everything that it entails to be on psychotropic medication. So you play down the risk. You do not have the discussion about the full extent of the side effects. Yeah, so, and I think patients know that. Patients know that. But I think for some patients, it can be really problematic to end up on medication that they no longer find useful, but they have great difficulties coming off as well.
So this is Mental Health Radio, Take It From Us. We have adopted a bit of a departure today by broadcasting an interview with a Dr. Pratima Singh, who's a UK psychiatrist, and that broadcast first appeared on madinamerica.com as one of their podcasts. So let's take a music break. We are playing Supertramp today with a track called Bloody Well Right.
You got a bloody right to say. say. Right, you're bloody well right. You know you got a right to say. You're bloody well right, you got a bloody right to say. Right, you're bloody well right, you know you got a right to say.
That's a classic Supertramp with a track called Bloody Well Right on Mental Health Radio, Take It From Us. If you've just joined us, we had a bit of a departure on Take It From Us by playing an interview from Mad in America. We've established a relationship with madinamerica.com and have permission to use podcasts from Mad in America. And this interview is with a UK psychiatrist, Dr. Pratima Singh.
It's a message that I've heard loud and clear, but I've also heard people say that they almost feel they've failed if they don't get a prescription after a consultation with a GP. So we as patients have a role to play too, don't we? It's very interesting also to hear that you felt that your training prepared you well to communicate the benefits of the medications, but you weren't necessarily as prepared when a patient said they didn't want the medications and asked what the options were.
So, James, I think it's an interesting point about, you know, so that we are all possibly party to this mindset that we have created. But I think, again, from a systemic point of view, when we approach medication as the first solution to any health problem, I mean, leave alone mental health. Mm-hmm. I mean, if we look at pain, for example, if that is our approach, I think we propagate this delusion that, you know, almost everything can be fixed by taking a pill. So, you know, a pill for every ill concept. So I think that is how our patients in their 60s end up with medication as long as their arm, which then, you know, lead to more side effects and then medication to treat those side effects. So I think it's a problem in every specialty, but I think it's a bigger problem in mental health because of the nature of medication. And like I said, combined with the ignorance on professionals' part about how these medications behave and how unexpected it is. So as a psychiatrist, I cannot predict. I don't have any test. I do not have any substantial means to predict how a person would react to a medication, what side effects they would get, and how easy or difficult it will be for them to come off the medication. And every time I've had this conversation with a person who's willing to have that conversation, they have made a choice to try other things before medication. And I think the same needs to happen at the level of the GP when somebody comes with pain. I think we need to tell them that, you know, you are taking this opioid and you will feel fantastic, but there is a chance that you will, you know, get addicted. And I think, you know, it's not a great example because I think that already happens to some extent. But I think that does not happen with mental health as much as it needs to.
I agree. And I just wondered, Dr. Singh, that the message that the medication is really more of a symptomatic thing and at best can only mask areas in your life where you may need to put effort into lasting change. That's a message that we need to give to many levels in the healthcare system. And I wondered how you felt we should best do that.
I guess, I mean, the honest answer to that would be that, you know, I just wish we knew and understood these medications better. So, you know, while James, I completely agree with you that many patients come and say, you know, I've lost count of how many times I've heard this, that it did something in the start and then it stopped acting. Yeah. So that is the major narrative. But then I also hear about patients who say that, you know, they have remained well, and every time, even though they have tried to come off it very sensibly, very slowly, often done by themselves, they just don't seem to do that well. And I think that is what first got me interested in this whole area about discontinuation and withdrawal. You know, maybe with more experience and more research, this will become clear to me. But I think so far, I just feel like we do not know enough. It's like, you know, using cancer drugs as first line. We don't, because we appreciate that they are pretty toxic. They are drugs that have to be used with a lot of caution. And I think that same degree of caution needs to apply to psychotropic medication rather than being used willy-nilly. I do not think that these medications are safe enough to be used the way that they do. And they can sometimes create problems and create clinical pictures that can actually lead to more iatrogenic harm. So more harm from the professional in an attempt to relieve a problem that they might have created in their first place. So I think for me, as a professional, that's the starting point. And I think I make it a point to do that in every clinical interaction with the patient, in my, you know, communication with the GP. So I make a lot of song dance about the fact that the patient is on this medication and it has to be kind of given due diligence that what it means to be on a toxic medication and what measures are required, not only in terms of monitoring and health advice, but what is required from the patient. So just to give an example, it is not the case that I do not prescribe medication, but if I am going to prescribe somebody an atypical antipsychotic, for example, like olanzapine or quetiapine, medication that we now know without doubt that have almost 100% increased risk of metabolic disorders like increased weight gain and therefore increased cardiovascular risk. If we know that 100%, I make it a point that I have that discussion almost on itself. And I almost ask for a commitment from the patient that if they are willing or if they want to go on this medication, this is what they will need to do in order to actually be on it. So I mean, over the years, I have had patients who have not put on any weight on these medication and have been on rather minimal dose because they have made a commitment to manage their lives, you know, lead much more active life, be much more mindful of what they are eating, you know, make sure that they manage stress in a way that reduces the possibility of them needing more and more medication or more than one medication in future, etc., whatnot. And I guess the same needs to apply to all medication. I mean, unfortunately, my place in the system is such that I sometimes have these conversations quite late. But I mean, in some ways, I don't think there is anything as too late. So I think as professionals, we need to stop this habitual prescribing, because I think a part of that is just not hearing these repeated accounts of patients saying that they had horrible side effects, or they missed one dose of medication and they had this acute withdrawal. We do not hear it. My colleagues do not believe or share the view that I do, that these medications create withdrawal or severe discontinuation symptoms, or that it is possible that a person can have these weeks, months, years after being on medication. They do not believe it, but I do, because that's what patients are telling me.
Well, I can certainly attest to that from personal experience. Any conversation that I've had with my doctors about psychotropic medications has been, here is the benefit you'll get, but there was no counterbalance in terms of you may experience these adverse effects or you may have a very difficult time coming off. There almost seemed to be a tacit assumption that staying on the drugs for life was the best approach, and I didn't have enough knowledge as a patient to question that assumption at the time.
And I guess those interactions are based on a relationship, and I think that is what makes me feel quite mindful of the responsibility, because I think it's a huge privilege to have that position where a person coming to you just by virtue of what you do professionally is going to trust you and be ready to do what you say. I mean, just imagine, there's no other profession in the world that comes with that kind of an advantage. But I think it's an advantage that we possibly take for advantage. And I think we need to be much more humble in taking on that responsibility so that we do not end up harming the patients unknowingly.
I agree. A person's health should be a collaboration, shouldn't it, rather than either a patient demanding or a medical professional being dogmatic about treatment. And Dr. Singh, I wanted to ask, in interviewing others for the podcast, I've heard the view that mental health needs a revolution, not an evolution. And I just wondered what your thoughts were about that, given your own experiences of the system.
Completely arrived at the same conclusion that, you know, making small tweaks and having, these little quality improvement initiatives to do this little bit better is possibly not going to change things as much as we need to. And I completely agree that we need a completely different mindset to look at mental health. And in my opinion, I think the first thing that we need to do is look at mental health, chronic mental health difficulties, in the same way as we look at any other chronic mental any other chronic physical health issue. So looking at a chronic condition of health as a result of things that have gone wrong chronically. So, I mean, these could be then looked at, you know, what has gone wrong in terms of the lifestyle or life experience, or what kind of traumas in a person's life has made them vulnerable to then manifest their genetic vulnerabilities. And, you know, where are the weak links for this person to fall prey to, you know, having a particular disorder? So I think the weak link for a person might be the mental health. For another person, it might be manifest as arthritis. In a third patient, it might be an autoimmune condition or an endocrine problems. But I think at the root of it, most chronic mental health diseases, like physical health diseases, are thought to be, you know, things that require a multi-pronged approach. And I guess this is where I think, you know, when I see a patient with mental health and I take an interest in their thyroid status or what their vitamin B12 level is or how they are eating, how much movement there is, and what is the burden of stress, I think it's all relevant, because those same things would affect how their thyroid is maintained. So me giving antidepressants can have a positive or a negative impact on everything else. And for the patient, they are interested in their health. That's it. They are not interested in you as a specialist doing well so that they feel well mentally, but then they're not able to get out of the bed because. So the patients don't see that. So I think it's a very easy model to speak to patients about, because they get it. You know, that's what they want for them. And I think, unfortunately, many of them think that this is how we already function, and we don't. But I think professionally, it's a much more difficult model to negotiate. So a transformation like this would actually mean that we do away with the mind-body split. Mm-hmm. We look at the mind as residing in the body and look at things much more in advance than wait till symptoms manifest. So, for example, in diabetes, you know, we look at, so when a person is gaining weight or, you know, kind of coming with descriptions of being under a lot of stress at work or having relationship difficulties, we see that as something that could potentially manifest in 10 years into explicit diabetes, and intervening now rather than, you know, what we do is, oh, you know, blood glucose is 0.4 within the normal. So you're all right for now. Go away and just wait for it to become a problem. I think that's the same approach sometimes, unfortunately, we take for mental health, that, you know, you're kind of doing all right. There aren't enough risks. Just let's wait for things to get worse. And I think that does not make any sense. So I think we have to do away with this acute care mindset and treat people like this. And in terms of mental health, I think that can only happen when the mental health professionals have enough time and opportunity to have those relationships, because I sometimes joke with my patients and with colleagues that, you know, sometimes our interaction with patients feels like an arranged marriage. They barely know us, and yet they are expected to engage with us with this intensity, you know. So pushed into therapy too soon, they have to meet the therapist every week, whereas no pre-work has gone on to prepare them for that stage. And I think then it becomes a torture for both the patient and the therapist, because, you know, the patient is just trying to get used to this whole setting and trying to make sense about whether they feel safe or, you know, if they trust the person enough to have a relationship, and then bring their vulnerability to do the work. And I think that pre-work needs to happen in having and building trusting relationship with a mental health professional that is not burdened by the pressure to move you through the system and discharge you back to your GP quickly, but actually look at, you know, what if I take time with you now, you are going to do better in future. And, you know, the system does better, because then, you know, the same patient does not get referred four times. But I think somehow the system, the way the system is set up now, it is all right for the patient to be referred four times a year, as long as they remain within your care pathway for X number of weeks. And I think that is very short-sighted, and it does not help the patients at all. And, you know, it will change. So I think this will manifest in terms of systemic problems, that we will continue these poorly evidence-based reconfigurations with financial focus in mind. We will continue to do this with such rapidity because it's not working. It's not working. So let's try this, let's try that, without really paying attention that what's really is not working is something much more basic that we need to fix first.
Well, this is Mental Health Radio. Take it from us. And we are broadcasting a Mad in America podcast today with a UK psychiatrist, Dr. Pratima Singh. Let's take another music break with Supertramp. And this track is called Dreamer. Well, that was Dreamer from Supertramp on Mental Health Radio. Take it from us on Planet FM 104.6. Let's return to this interview, which was first broadcast as a podcast by Mad in America. It's with a Dr. Pratima Singh, who's a UK psychiatrist.
I agree, and it's such a refreshingly different approach to some of the frankly quite disempowering discussions that I've had in the past. Things like, it's a chemical imbalance and there's nothing you can do about it, take a tablet and depend on it for life, as opposed to recognizing that the power is within the individual to change their life. That's quite a different model to where we are now, isn't it?
I think it is a very different model, but again, I think that model only works if we are engaged with the person at the right time. So, I mean, imagine if a person comes to me who's severely depressed, who's just like completely the end of the tether, possibly suicidal, me having a discussion about eating well or running. It's going to possibly frustrate them and make them feel really misunderstood because, you know, I'm expecting something that's completely not at par with what they feel able to do that. But I think that is the pressure that we create on the system, that when we engage with people later and later on after exhausting many of the interventions that should have been tried, you know, much further along the line, is that I think we are setting up the patient to fail and we are setting up ourselves to fail as well. I think these discussions are much better placed with the GP in the primary care and then continued and possibly worked on further when they come to see specialist mental health workers. And, you know, I will again reiterate the fact that, you know, there is so little that we know about, you know, why in a group of patients medication seem to work, and the whole thing about work can be interpreted in many ways, you know, maybe placebo. But, I mean, emerging science is really making us question about what we know about mental health in the way it's present as well as its treatment. So for an example, the role of stress or the role of inflammation in mental health is quite topical. And I think one thing that people realize about SSRI medication is that it seemed to have some impact on reducing inflammation. You know, so is that why it's working? And if we look at, you know, something positive and new like that with our old mindset, the obvious solution to that would be, oh, let's give them more anti-inflammatory drugs. So they not only are on SSRI, we add another drug and hope that would improve. That would be the old mindset. The new mindset, or looking at things in this more evolved way, would be, you know, hang on, rather that if this is what we now know, that possibly a mechanism by which these medications seem to act is by reducing inflammation. What are the pro-inflammatory things that this patient has in its in his or her life that we could target on before we go on to drugs? So, you know, the role of stress in increasing inflammation, the role of sleep in inducing inflammation, the role of a junk food, you know, standard Western diet in promoting inflammation. I mean, these cost little compared to medication or, you know, inpatient. So I think this is the change in the mindset that I am interested in, and I try to do with my patients and tell them, see, this does not have side effects. I'm yet to come across a patient who has said that they are feeling worse by looking after themselves. But I think it also puts back the ownership in the patient's hand and helps them, you know, at their own pace, examine the areas of their life that they never thought to be problematic when they had this skill-based approach. So I think, I feel that is how things need to change. And it's very, very, very drastic to what we are doing currently.
It is, isn't it? And it would be a lovely place to move to. And Dr. Singh, you mentioned earlier that resources are one of the barriers to us moving in this new direction. And I wondered if you felt there were other barriers that would make it difficult to move to this multidisciplinary approach to mental health.
Absolutely. I think there are so many ego at work. And I've been curious about why is it so hard for people to hear about a different view. And, you know, as I said earlier, psychiatry has always struggled to recruit people. And one of the criticisms of psychiatrists is that they're not real doctors. And, you know, while when people say that to me, I just laugh. But I think there are other people for whom that might be quite significant. So it does feel like a doctor when you are writing prescriptions and ordering tests and having these very concrete, definitive, confident discussions or recommendations to patients, even though they might not be based in evidence all the time. So I think that is quite, it's a threat to the identity of the profession to let go of something that it has sought solace in for so long. I think what is interesting about the history of psychiatry as compared to other specialties is that there have been voices of discontent throughout. And I think within the profession, the split sometimes manifests as psychiatrist versus psychologist, where, you know, even within the same profession, people see themselves as being on two opposite sides. And on the same hand, there are other people who feel very comfortable about being quite pro-therapy, but you would have the same kind of a rigidity and lack of open-mindedness about any other way to engage a patient other than therapy. So I'm actually critical about rigidity in any way. And I'm quite mindful that, you know, my personal bias might be to use less medication and to be more lifestyle focused and be more relational. And what could I be missing? And I think the best way to do that is to listen to your patient. Because I think everything I have learned is because of that. Yeah, I still remember my first appointment as a consultant psychiatrist, my first patient who mentioned something about, you know, an alternative way to deal with her bipolar. My first assumption when she said that was, oh, it's, you know, she possibly didn't have bipolar in the first place. You know, she was, I mean, I'm really ashamed to say that I assumed that, you know, she's either one of those people with bipolar who's been misdiagnosed, or she just, you know, yeah. It can't be. You cannot treat bipolar without medication. When I went back to her notes, she was as bipolar can be. I mean, whatever you make of that diagnosis. So she had these classic episodes of severe, functional impairment where she was manic and psychotic. So she had. And then in my future reviews with her, I started to have a much more open mind, ask her what she had been doing, go away and do the research. And that's how it started for me. I think the other place where, you know, I thought I had the great advantage of having a bit of a break from psychiatry to create or develop my own mindset was when I got the opportunity to actually take a year off and do a leadership and management fellowship. Mm-hmm. And in that fellowship, I got an opportunity to look at the evidence for, you know, lots of things that work and don't work in healthcare and how people contrast. And I think what really bemused me is how, especially in NHS, how we can be very attached to things that don't well just because that's what we are used to. I was so influenced by what I learned in that year that after my return and after being a part of a service reconfiguration where two excellent clinical services were shut down because they did not make financial sense, I was inspired enough to go and do a business degree. And again, I think the themes were the same. The themes were the same that in order to do well, you have to listen to your customers with an open mind and you have to listen carefully because they will tell you exactly what you need for things to work. And for me, those have been my patients. So if my patient comes and tells me, no, this, I actually felt suicidal 4 days after starting this medication, I no longer disregard that. I don't say that I 100% take on board everything the patient is saying, but I am much more able to hear that and keep that in mind and listen to their story in context of what they believe really happened. Because that is what led me back to looking at the literature and finding out, to my horror, that there are numerous papers and numerous reports about antidepressants having that effect. So next time when that happened in my own practice, unlike my colleagues, I did not say, oh, it's was possibly not the medication, you know, and just kind of attributing it to the patient. So I think it has been a process. And I wonder how many of us within mainstream services will have those kind of experiences where they get to develop that openness. But We have to. I think at some point you have to stop and ask, you know, if these things are really so effective, why is psychiatric morbidity increasing? Why are more people unwell if we are prescribing, you know, 60 million prescriptions a year? I mean, shouldn't that translate into some improvement? You know, some, but, you know, if anything but that is true. And there are people who are saying that we are not medicating people enough and that more and more people need to be treated. And I think treated is equated with medication. And I think that's very uncreative. I think treatment needs to be what the patient believes will help them. And if that's medication, so be it, by having a full disclosure and informed consent. But if it's not, you know, spending that time developing that relationship to find out what that could be.
I think that's very important. And again, it's great to hear that there are professionals who will question the current paradigm. Dr. Singh, I wanted to go on to ask a little bit about functional medicine, which, if I'm honest, is quite a new thing for me, and I'm very excited by what I've read so far. And I wondered if you could help me understand how functional medicine contrasts to the mainstream psychiatric approach that we've been used to.
Right. So so my array again into functional medicine model was fueled by my quest to have answers. Yeah. I think at one point, I would say around 7 years ago, I had this personal and professional crisis where I thought, oh my God, you know, I feel I'm passionate about working in mental health, but what I'm seeing is not what I can envisage myself doing for the next 30 years.
Well, that's the end of the interview with Dr. Pratima Singh on Mental Health Radio. Take it from us. Special thanks to Mad in America for their permission to broadcast some of the podcasts that they are broadcasting in the United States. Let's have another track from Supertramp, and this one's called Give a Little Bit. Give a little bit of your love to me. Well, I'm Sheldon Brown on Mental Health Radio. Take it from us. Just want to bring you a notice about in the lead up to the 2017 elections, Navigate, which is a mental health and addictions provider group, is hosting a political forum where all political parties will be represented. This is on Wednesday, the 30th of August, so it's next week. It's at 7 p.m. in the evening, and it is at the One Tree Hill College Hall, which is 421 to 451 Great South Road, Penrose. I think it's very close to the off-ramp off the Southern Motorway at Penrose. So this is the 30th of August, run by Navigate, and it's all about the lead-up to the 2017 elections and political parties giving insights into their approach to mental health and addictions. Now, next week on Take It From Us, Mental Health Radio, we'll be talking to the organiser of a Y579 Ride One Dayer. This is to support suicide prevention education and services in our community, as particularly supporting Lifeline Aotearoa. It's $20 per rider, and it looks as though they're riding from Auckland down into the Waikato. We're going to be talking to one of the key organisers of Y579, Troy Manley, next week on Mental Health Radio. You can pick up information about this in advance of our broadcast on Facebook. So this is called Y579. So check that out on Facebook. And all money raised helps ensure Lifeline can continue to support those in need. Well, that's been Take It From Us this week. We look forward to listeners being back to hear about this Y579 ride, a one-dayer to support suicide prevention, education and services in our community. Thanks for listening.